One interesting thing, you know, in my history is that when I was a kid, you know, back in the 60s, I used to, like, read everything from J. Allen Hynek. And this guy, I figured, you know, he was an astronomer. My gosh, you know, he was always into this stuff. And he was the Air Force consultant for 20 years, and now he's investigating UFOs on his own. Who knew that one day that I would be working with him and writing a book with the guy? It's almost like, you know, one of these dreams come true.
Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. No theme music this week. We'll detail all that at the end of the show because you have been waiting far too long for this installment of BOA Audio. Not only is our guest one of the most frequently requested names by the BOA Audio listeners when I poll them for potential future guests on the program, but also I have been particularly captivated by his work as I've gotten to discover more and more of his stuff. And the more I talk to him and the more I look at his material, the more blown away I am by this guy's research. He really is razor-sharp, cutting-edge, looking at the world of the paranormal and trying to apply science to the paranormal and trying to tie all these seemingly disparate genres together in order to find some kind of answers to the big questions that we all ponder. Of course, I'm talking about legendary ufologist Phil Imbrogno, who finally arrives on BOA Audio for a nearly two-hour conversation. In this interview, we're going to cover Phil's lengthy career examining UFOs and high strangeness events, how his philosophy on the paranormal has evolved over the years, and how he sees this enigmatic field today. Along the way, we're going to discuss the Hudson Valley UFO flap, reptilians, channeling, specifically the mind-blowing case of Dean Fagerstrom, the Djinn 2012, and a whole bunch more fringe areas which may hold the key to unlocking many paranormal mysteries. What I particularly like and respect about Phil Imbrogno is that he is willing to examine the outlier cases in ufology and in the paranormal field and look at a lot of stuff that some of the more mainstream researchers just won't touch because the material is way too far out for them. It's not too far out for Phil Imbrogno. He dives in and really gets his hands around some remarkable material and some seriously mind-blowing information. Altogether, this is truly an episode of BOA Audio that will have you pondering the very nature of the paranormal as we're going to examine a number of esoteric outliers with Phil Imbrogno, a true maverick of high strangeness research. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Phil Imbrogno, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Phil Imbrogno has been investigating and researching paranormal phenomena for over 30 years. He has a BA degree in astronomy from the University of Texas, a BS degree in earth science from Northeastern/Boston College, and a master's degree in chemistry from MIT. He's been a science educator for the past 25 years, and has authored countless magazine articles on science and the paranormal, and has appeared or done research for a number of major television presentations on UFOs, astronomy, and the paranormal. He's the author of Night Siege, The Hudson Valley UFO Sightings, Files from the Edge, Interdimensional Universe, and his latest book, Ultra-Terrestrial Contact. Unfortunately, Phil does not have a webpage, but you can find out more from him at the website for Llewellyn Books, Llewellyn, or just punch in Phil Imbrogno on Google and you'll find a whole bunch of stuff on him. Phil Imbrogno, Imbrogno. With all that said, let's get down to business, folks, and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on January 18th, 2011. Phil Imbrogno, talking about ultra-terrestrial contact and paranormal outliers on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. I'm really looking forward to this week's installment of the program. Our guest, I like to think of him as one of the unsung legends in the world of ufology. He's been looking at the phenomenon for over 30 years, not just ufology, but also high strangeness in general.
And he's not out for glory. He's out for answers, and that's what I really respect about him. And he also takes a look at a lot of the outlier cases and the cases that don't seem to fit into the paradigm that the world of UFOs and UFO research seems to have created for the phenomenon. So he's doing some really amazing work and under the radar in a big way. He's been requested numerous times by many of the listeners to BOA Audio, so I'm sure they're going to be very excited to hear him on the program. He's the author of most notably Interdimensional Universe and Files from the Edge, as well as Night Siege, which is about the Hudson Valley UFO flap. And his latest book is Ultra-Terrestrial Contact, A Paranormal Investigator's Explorations into the Hidden Abduction Phenomenon. I've had the pleasure of not just working with him at the Exeter UFO Festival, but also spending the day with him in Hudson Valley, checking out the stone chambers. It was just an amazing experience for me and quite an education and a real thrill. So I'm looking forward to sort of continuing that experience here on the program for all you folks. He is, of course, Phil Imbrogno. Phil, welcome to BOA Audio. It's been a long time coming. Hopefully this is the first of many future appearances.
Well, thank you, Tim. It's good to talk to you again. And that was some day out there tracking down the chambers.
For sure. I should mention to you, this is sort of a break from script here, but when I went home, I looked into this, and there is a stone chamber right here in my town, but it's much different from the ones we saw. I'll have to take some pictures and send it to you. It's very
small. Like to see it.
Yeah, it's very small. It's only about 3 feet high. It was a very interesting sort of little place to discover. Now, as I said, you've been doing this for like 30 years, and I'm a little concerned about asking for the bio background, but let's do it. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, how you got into looking at high strangeness and UFOs and, you know, how your career sort of evolved. And as I said, this is probably the first of many installments of conversation between you and I, because I definitely want to dig into the historical aspect of UFO studies sometime in the future with you, because that's sort of my forte. That's sort of my wheelhouse. But let's talk a little bit, you know, about your career, how you got started in all this, what sparked your interest, and where it all led.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been a good number of years there, you know, and I look back at it, it's hard to believe that all of those decades have passed. But, you know, my interest began in the 60s. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were so many UFO magazines out then. This is when, you know, you would see it on UFO shows on TV all the time, and, I mean, they were all over.
Yeah.
And, you know, that fascinated me. So I would, like, turn on the TV, and I would see people like, you know, Dr. J. Allen Hynek on TV talking about UFOs and so on. And then, you know, I went into the military, and when I got out, I still had a great interest in the UFO phenomena. And, you know, when I got out of, well, while I was in the military and after I got out, I went to school for astronomy, you know, my first degree down in Texas. And I was, you know, still fascinated. I did a lot of investigation, you know, while I was in the military.
Yeah.
And while I was a student in school. And, you know, I'm interested in astronomy, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea that UFOs represent extraterrestrial spacecraft would fascinate anybody. And so I decided to really start investigating UFOs in detail back in 1975. And my first, you know, like everybody else back then, you know, was always an open field.
Yeah.
And it was like just on the fringe of when, you know, the United States government stopped investigating UFOs not too many years after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really nobody knew how to investigate the phenomena. We would see various books and read various books that were out there by Frank Edwards and Donald Kehoe and so on. And, you know, we would pick up these investigation techniques that, you know, almost copied, like, what the government might do back then during Project Blue Book, even though they didn't investigate very many cases. And, you know, my idea at that time was that, you know, UFOs were probably extraterrestrial and they were nuts and bolts spaceships and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And cases came into my direction and I was kind of dismayed by it. I thought that the cases were, you know, the information was vague and could have been misinterpretation of just about anything. And I started becoming somewhat of a skeptic and saying, you know, this is what people are seeing. Probably everything that was in the papers and everything else I've read is probably over-exaggerated.
Yeah.
I realized that, you know, I was just touching the tip of the iceberg. And as I became more well-known, having, you know, certain articles done on my work and so on and so on, more cases came to my attention, and I began to realize this was a very complex phenomena. And, you know, of course, my big introduction into big-time UFO investigation began with the Hudson Valley case.
Yeah.
But one interesting thing, you know, in my history is that when I was a kid, you know, back in the 60s, mm-hmm. I used to, like, read everything from J. Allen Hynek. And this guy, I figured, you know, he was an astronomer. My gosh, you know, he was always into this stuff. And he was the Air Force consultant for 20 years, and now he's investigating UFOs on his own. Who knew that one day that I would be working with him and writing a book with the guy? It's almost like, you know, one of these dreams come true.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's basically it. You know, the big-time introduction into UFOs began with the Hudson Valley case.
When did you, like, shift from – it sounds like you sort of got into it and you sort of had the pragmatic approach, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, that it's nuts and bolts. And you know, I've heard in the past that, you know, they didn't even touch the you know, the alien contact part of it, especially when you first started getting into this. You know, when did you sort of shift to more, you know, open-mindedness towards the paranormal end of it, if you will? You know, that hopefully that makes makes sense. It's sort of a vague, big terms there, but yeah, I think you know what
I mean. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. You know, back in the 70s, we were more interested in collecting reports that sounded like alien encounters and, you know, aliens are here for scientific exploration and, you know, picking up little flowers and plants and, you know, examining people and so on and their spaceships from, you know, fantastic spaceships from another star system and so on and so on. But there was something else that was attached to the phenomena itself, a bizarre aspect of it that was did not indicate aliens, but indicated something else, which today we call the paranormal. And when these cases came to my attention, I really didn't know how to handle them. You know, people claiming contact experience, claiming to be abducted by aliens and so on and so on. And I did investigate some of them, but, you know, went away scratching my head saying, you know, how does this apply to the UFO phenomena? It has nothing to do with aliens, yet this whole experience that these people were having started with a UFO encounter and just grew into something else that's, you know, bizarre.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, then the Hudson Valley case took place, and once again people were reporting what's they thought was a solid object. And, you know, but then again, there were also cases of high strangeness that popped up that were outside of the normal realm of a UFO sighting, if you can consider UFO sightings normal.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, these cases popped up. But during the investigation, as you know, that J. Allen Hynek, Alan and I did quite a bit of field work on these cases. And he would not touch all of the contact cases and all of the abduction cases that were coming to us. And he said to me, you know, UFOs are hard enough to believe. We have to make this respectable. You cannot give the media these cases. They'll have a field day with it. And it would, you know, end up making the whole thing look ridiculous. And I argued with him on a number of occasions saying, you know, it's part of the phenomena, whether it's psychological, whether it's just a fantasy or a psychosis or something, or if it's real, it's part of the UFO experience. And, of course, you know, he would just look at me and, you know, puff on his pipe and say, we are not investigating those cases.
Wow.
But as time went on, you know, I began to realize this was all part of the UFO experience. And the UFO is UFO phenomena is part of the paranormal world. Many UFO investigators will probably deny this and think that, you know, well, you know, UFOs are aliens. It's scientific. No, it's all part of the paranormal world. There's no science in the investigation of UFOs.
Yeah, because we can't even wrap our minds around it. We can't even wrap our science around it. So how we, you know,
right.
It's
you know,
using the wrong
science. Science is based on the scientific method. The scientific method was devised from observing physical events using physical instruments and our senses. You know, you cannot document something that is so fleeting, that is phantasm in nature, like the UFO phenomena. So the scientific method breaks down considerably. And I say all the time to UFO investigators, and they, you know, they just walk away saying, Pete, we have to develop a new mode of investigation, a new rules for investigating UFOs. You can't walk away and say, we can't accept this, it's not scientific. There's no science in the investigation of UFOs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I totally agree with you. And like I said in the introduction, what I really respect about your work, especially this book, is that you really, you know, you're willing to look at the outlier cases quite a bit. And this book is chock full of outlier cases. And that may be where we need to go to get more information, because clearly, you know, the standard UFO sighting and the standard abduction stories just aren't cutting it as far as, you know, learning more about what's really going on.
That is true. That is true. And this is why for so many years, people involved with UFO research have just been going around in circles.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just been, you know, they just really, many of them, you know, get into these sidelines with, you know, paranoia and stuff like that. And this is why, you know, we really haven't accomplished anything in the field for the past 30 years. I mean, it's because no one really wants to look at it for what it really is. And the paranormal, everything in the paranormal is the same way. People who are investigating ghost sightings, you know, the whole phenomena is ghost. People who are investigating, like, demonology, oh, everything is, you know, these entities, these demons. People investigating UFOs are saying, oh, you know, they're aliens from another world. You just can't look at this phenomena and say, you know, put one label on it. The paranormal, including UFOs, is a very, very complex thing that probably has very, very many different types of origins.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And the title of the book, Ultra-Terrestrial Contact, that sort of sets the stage in a way for your theory, I guess you could say, or the way you see it now, which is that, you know, we're not dealing with a straight-up extraterrestrial thing. It may be, you know, it may be part of it, but we're also dealing with something that's interdimensional in nature and you know, has different laws of reality than what we're dealing with.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm not saying that the entire UFO, what we call the UFO phenomena, the UFO experience, is in fact, you know, interdimensional or from another dimension or another reality or so on. Some of it may be extraterrestrial. I believe there are, you know, many different explanations for many different cases. So anyone investigating UFOs really should be very well versed in the entire paranormal spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're dealing with UFOs, every aspect of the paranormal is going to eventually show up.
Yeah, yeah. And I've talked to, you know, my friend Greg Bishop says this all the time, that, you know, when investigating a UFO case, it seems like the investigators miss out on a lot of information by not really asking the experiencer or the witness, you know, how they felt and what, you know, what became of them during the event, after the event, you know, what was the change that went on in them. That might be another area that, you know, there could be considerable amount of information that we just haven't really cultivated yet.
This is true. People who have a true paranormal experience, a true encounter with a UFO, in many cases, it totally changes their life. And you see people who continue to have experiences, they try to interpret the event to make them comfortable. Human beings do not like something unknown happening in their life. They like to feel that their lives are very secure. So when they have a paranormal event, they try to interpret it so that they can deal with it psychologically in their life and become part of their life.
Yeah.
UFO experiences, paranormal experiences, are usually interpreted according to the witness's upbringing, philosophical beliefs, religious beliefs, education, and just whatever part of culture they are in the world. So you're, because the UFO phenomena and a paranormal event doesn't expose itself to you. The people are left trying to fill in the gaps and interpret as to what's happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say, okay, you know, there's a paranormal event taking place, let's get the scientists out there.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine and dandy, but you know, you need more than just the scientist out there. It's a multidisciplinary sort of thing, an investigation of the paranormal. So you need teams of people from trained in many different disciplines to go out there and look at it, because it is that complex. The physical scientist falls very, very short when it comes to the investigations of the paranormal.
Yeah, this is a very fleeting phenomenon. It certainly barely ever leaves anything aside, maybe some trace cases behind. So,
and, of course, the psychological effects on the person.
Exactly, yeah.
And also, you know, the psychological effects on the person and how it changed their life and so on and so on. In my investigations over the year, I've talked to people who have their lives totally changed. I mean, going from, you know, Mr. Everyday Life, going to work 9 to 5, you know, beach in the summertime with the kids and everything, to have this life, this pattern, totally changed. Not like they're trying to escape. It's that a paranormal event took place that totally changed this entire style of life. And for the most part, many people cannot handle it. But then again, you know, some do in their own way to try to deal with it so they can continue on with their life.
Yeah, and I've also noticed sort of, too, that, you know, I haven't had any specific experiences myself, but like the more you look into this sort of thing, it does change your perspective on the world in a way where, you know, it's like almost a Copernicus type thing. You realize that you're not really the center of the universe anymore. The human race isn't even the center of the universe. So we're dealing with, you know, we're a speck of sand on a massive beach, probably.
And that's true. And when people begin to realize this, that there's something else out there that they are not in control of, yeah, it really, really freaks some people out.
Yeah, yeah.
Human beings do not like the unknown predator waiting in the dark for them.
Yeah.
And this is part of the paranormal, because in many cases, it's the person's own fears that triggers, you know, a lot of these psychological disorders and imbalances that occur with many people.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in the book, you mentioned the shift from flying saucers to black triangles and how you think that indicates an entirely different intelligence. So I guess talk a little bit about that and you know, how you came to that sort of conclusion, because I found that pretty interesting. Because in a way, you know, this study of UFOs really is almost entirely reaction-based. You know, we always have to sort of be catching up to what we're given. This is a very interesting perspective here, because we're seeing a change and we're trying to come to some kind of conclusion about what that actually means.
Oh, yeah. You know, saucers, flying saucers are, you know, old-fashioned and the shape is gone. I mean, people still see discs, but these triangulars are taking place more. And what people have to remember is that, you know, the first UFOs that were seen were not triangular. You know, 1947, the modern era of UFOs, as you well know. You know, Kenneth Arnold did not see discs. He said he saw, like, boomerang-shaped objects.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he called them, you know, when somebody asked him, what did they look like? They looked like saucers skipping across water. I mean, flying saucers. Oh, boy, what a name for the press. But it's interesting to note that as soon as those headlines hit, flying saucers, people imagined in their mind what a flying saucer must look like. It's a disc. Yet people went out there and started seeing discs now. And people were seeing these flying saucers all over the place, these discs. And even the movies at the time, in the 50s going into the 60s, used people's descriptions to model the alien ships in the movies, all the way up to the 60s. And we see these flying saucer encounters, and many of them are classic with the discs and so on. But all in all, the sightings almost seem benign and fun to read about. Then all of a sudden, you know, we see more and more of these dark triangles appearing, and UFOs seem to get more aggressive, going around military bases, having encounters with people having terrifying encounters instead of wondrous encounters like they did in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
So the encounters that people have changed when the dark triangles appear to something that was wondrous, that was reported to be wondrous, to something that ended up terrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you see many of the reports is that these UFOs become more aggressive. Obviously, you know, there's an intelligence behind behind this, and it seems to have become more aggressive. To me, that indicates, you know, a whole different aspect of the UFO phenomena, something else, another intelligence.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, we've looked back on previous, to extrapolate a little bit, stories, you know, like folk tales and stuff like that, and how, you know, we may be dealing with this phenomenon of UFOs, maybe it's gone on for the history of humankind, it just keeps changing its perception to what we expect it to be, sort of like the airships of the 1800s. And then it makes you wonder what is it, why is it changing to black triangles, why, you know, what does it all mean, I guess you could say. In a great way, the book here really, it left me with a lot more questions than than I had going into it, which I really like a lot, because it left me with a lot of food for thought having read it. But it makes you wonder, you know, if the phenomenon is changing to our perceptions, then why would we perceive them, you know, to be this way? I don't know.
It's the age of paranoia. So this is what happened. You can see the mentality in the 50s is quite different than the mentality of today.
Yeah.
People were looking for, let's say, saviors from space, so they had to be kind people because the Cold War was on and everything. And even though the Cold War was on, there was still, you know, a different psyche in the United States, especially North America, during the 50s. And then as the 60s and the 70s and the 80s evolved, and now we're in the 21st century, the way people think and they view things has changed considerably. Now, one of the things that, you know, I think the media reflects the psyche of the population, because if you look at some of the movies that, have appeared in the past, in the 80s, going into the 90s, about UFOs and aliens, they're mostly like the aliens are, for the most part, you know, harmless and so on, and explorers. And now all of these movies coming out show these horrible invaders, are here to eat us and kill us and, you know, and do everything like that. So this is a reflection of the UFO phenomena. So when people go and see these movies now, when they see UFOs, you know, they get a terrifying effect. It seems as if the phenomena itself manifests according to how we want to see it. It almost seems like it adapts to the human race to make its biggest impact on the psychological makeup of the population of that generation at the time.
Yeah. You'd think, given the sad state of affairs in the world today, that maybe we'd see a return to the savior-esque ETs or something along those lines, given how lousy things are right now in the world. But I guess that's a wait-and-see sort of observation.
Well, people are so afraid in the world today with everything going on with viruses.
Yeah, they wouldn't even trust the savior.
Terrorism and war. That, you know, I don't think, you know, they're looking for saviors anymore. They're waiting for the big stone to fall upon their heads.
Yeah, that's true.
And end it all. So, you know, if it's not going to come from space from an asteroid hitting the Earth or the sun going to have eruptions or the tilt of the Earth changing, I mean, we have, you know, in human history, you have never seen all these things of aspects of doom. And now UFOs themselves have become part of that doomsday scenario.
Absolutely. And I noticed, too, you mentioned in the book that the emergence of the black triangles seem to coincide with the emergence of reptilians as a sort of a secondary dominant ET species alongside the greys. And you have the chart in the back of the book that based on all the cases that you've looked at and instances of contact with these different types of beings, I was stunned that the reptilians constituted 44%, which was equal to the greys in the chart. Seems like the reptilians are a bit underrepresented in a lot of UFO literature. I know, obviously, they're sort of tied in with the praying mantis type creatures, but still, even then, I always got the impression that they were, you know, a minority, if you will, and it sounds more like they're right up there with the greys, as far as what people are reporting.
Yes, they are, especially in the New York area. You have to remember that, I base all that information on my research, and I believe my research is a small cross-section of the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was lucky in the fact that I was in the center of, you know, one of the biggest UFO flaps in history, and that there was just so much information. My gosh, you know, in the 80s, people were very reluctant to report their encounters. But now, you know, people are more willing to talk about it. And I'm getting people are contacting me who had sightings back in the 80s up in the Hudson Valley in New York. So the data is still coming in. And yes, you know, in all of these contact cases where beings have been reported, a big chunk of the percentage up in this area in New England was reptilian in nature. And whenever I get cases now, I get very few cases of the grays. I get cases of these insectoid reptilian type of beings who seem to be, quite nasty.
That's the impression I got from reading the book here. It's very interesting. It's very strange. And not as much of the Nordic creatures or beings that as I had originally thought would be the case, I guess you could say.
They're there in the literature. They're there in the cases that I've investigated, but they seem to be the Nordic type, the tall blondes, you know, the angelic type of beings. They seem to be, you know, much rarer than they have in the past. There's not that many reports, and they seem to be dropping considerably as the years go by.
Makes me wonder why the reptilians are almost underrepresented in the literature, obviously outside of this book. It seems like maybe partially it might be due to the whole David Icke effect in a way, where it's like he sort of, you know, laid claim to the reptilians, and then it went down a very different rabbit hole, and maybe people in the UFO community are afraid to touch reptilians now because of that whole thing. But, I mean, I don't know. That's just speculation on my part.
Well, I think it stems from the fact that, you know, the UFO investigators are like, many of them are like horses with blinders.
Yeah.
On the sides of their face. They only see what they want to see in front of them. And the grays represent, you know, the typical classical alien visitor in UFO literature, but there are a multitude of beings that are also reported in UFO encounters that are not considered. And when some people who are researching UFOs, they encounter something outside of, you know, outside the box, something else way out there, they have a tendency to discount it and say it's a fake case, it's not real.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't fall in the parameters of what I've researched and what I know.
That's disappointing. That's why I give you kudos for daring to take on these outlier cases, because those are the ones that, you know, seem to have the most interesting information in them and break the mold, if you will, on what we've been looking at.
Well, like I said, I believe it's all part of the UFO experience. In order for us to really understand this phenomena, we just can't throw pieces away because they don't fit at the moment. We have to collect all the pieces and then finally put it together to see what the big picture really is. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to solve this at all. You have to be more open-minded. When people become paranormal UFO investigators, they have to go in with an objective mind, not a skeptical mind, but objective. Go into a case not knowing what to expect and accept everything and collect the data and then do a comparison when you have enough information. And also share your information with other people. And, you know, and really, you can't let your ego get into this. For example, there are many people who, you know, get involved in a case and they try to support it and they say, yes, yes, this is true, this is true. And they really, you know, let their ego get involved in that, you know. Just let the facts fall where they might. And, you know, whatever the outcome, but it's all a contribution to a study of this phenomena, which, it's incredibly complex.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's so hard to wrap your mind around. It's, you know, I guess that's what keeps it driving us too, you know, to get closer and closer to finding more of these pieces to put together the puzzle all together.
Well, in the world of the paranormal, there's always something to explore. And if people read my books, you'll see how my ideas begin to change and how I'm putting the information together. So when I, for example, in my first book on the paranormal, Night Seeds, the Hudson Valley UFO sightings, you know, that was the beginning of UFO investigations. And then, you know, the books after that, they're not just, you know, random books that are done. They're actually information based on my other research that's basing on my original research, slowly moving forward to try to get answers. So all of my books are like, you know, part one, part two, part three, part four, part five. And you know, they cover a wide range of my explorations into the world of the paranormal and the UFO phenomena, as you well know.
Absolutely. I mean, the Stone Chamber stuff alone was, I mean, that was not really related to UFOs at all, but quite interesting and could provide a lot of answers to other stuff. So,
well, that came in as a sideline to the UFO phenomena. And the Stone Chambers came to my attention because of my investigations into UFOs in the Hudson Valley. And there was a connection between, you know, the locations of these stone chambers and the appearance of the UFOs and the high strangeness that originated in those areas. I mean, for example, you know, when I started plotting all of the information of the UFO sightings on a map, I began to realize that, you know, the Hudson Valley UFO case centered around a number of towns. That's Putnam Valley, Kent Cliffs, and Brewster, New York. And then I took another map and plotted all of those cases of high strangeness, something outside of the ordinary UFO experience. And these high strangeness encounters were not spread all over the place. They were clustered. And, of course, the next thing to do was to go out there and find out what was in that cluster. And every cluster I went to, I found one of these stone chambers. The first time I saw one, I said, wow, what's that? And I did some research on it and read a book by Barry Fell talking about them. And yeah, people know about these things. They're a mystery. Then I went to another location and I found another stone chamber in an area that marked in the high strangeness. And another one, I says, this has to be more than a coincidence. And going on and doing more research, I found out that historically, strange phenomena has been reported around these stone structures, which are thought to be thousands of years old. And it seems that someone was actually marking locations where, let's say, various unusual events took place, which could have been interpreted as religious in nature at one time or manifestation of spirits. Mm-hmm. There was no coincidence, for example, that the center of UFO activity in the Hudson Valley was in these locations in towns that had the highest concentrations of stone chambers. Some of these stone chambers were not placed randomly. They were placed over specific areas. And the Native Americans, by the way, believe that they are on locations that mark doorways to another world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you make the point, too, in the book that you know, it seems like the Native Americans, they may be a little more in tune with what's really going on here, or their cultural history includes information about this stuff, that they know more about this than maybe we're giving them credit for, and we need to look at that stuff a little more carefully.
What we have to do is look at these legends and consider that some of them are based on reality. And even though they're told by people at a different time, and the language they use is different to try to describe something, we just can't discount something as being folklore or just a crazy legend. But many of the Native American legends, the Wappinger, the Algonquin, and so on, in the Hudson Valley area, talk about creatures, beings, lights that come from another world that emit from particular areas that they called sacred ground at one time. And what they're describing sounds like our UFO encounters of today. I'll give you one quick example, is that there's a place in Putnam called Ninim Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And for Native Americans, believe that on top of the mountain there is the spirits from the other world come into our existence, and they are like beautiful glowing colors of lights, and they come out of the clouds to the top of the mountain, and that's how they enter our world. Now, today, people are still seeing those spirits of the mountains, the lights appearing up there, but they're not calling them spirits, they're calling them UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Very strange stuff, very strange stuff. And another area that you tackle in the book is sort of the phenomenon, I guess you could say, of channeling, which I thought was really commendable because a lot of people would just turn a blind eye to channeling and throw it all out. And one particular story that really blew me away was Dean Fagerstrom, J. Dean Fagerstrom, and his tale. So I guess talk a little bit about that, because it seemed like you put a lot of, I wouldn't say credence, but you certainly, you know, thought that this was worthy of discussion, if you will.
Wow, is it? I'll tell you.
Yeah, it was pretty mind-blowing stuff.
Well, when getting into channeling, yes, most UFO investigators will shy away from channeling. And personally, you know, 90-something percent of all the channelers that I investigated that proved to me that they were, you know, just in contact with their own imaginations or trying to get an audience, or, you know, they're frustrated actors or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, or the frustrated religious preachers trying to get a, you know, an audience or a following. But when I was investigating the contact phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
and these are cases that, you know, Alan Hynek and other people would not touch, I figured that, you know, I'm just not going to look into cases where people claim to be abducted by aliens. I was going to explore the entire contact experience. That means people having manifestations, seeing what they call angels, all the way to spirits, all the way to ghosts, all the way to aliens, and so on and so on.
Yeah, contact with like anything almost.
Yes, you know, anything that was otherworldly, you know, that type of contact experience. And of course, I became very frustrated. I mean, I could tell you really some comical adventures that I've had with some of these channelers.
Mm-hmm.
And but I believe channeling, it seems that some people are in contact with a higher intelligence or some type of intelligence, but it's very rare. For example, as you're talking about J. Dean Fagerstrom. Okay, I'll give you the basic information on this guy. He was a night watchman. So, you know, the education was somewhat limited, and of course, you know, he didn't have much of a technical background. And he originally wrote a letter to Dr. Hynek. And Dr. Hynek was so impressed with the letter that he contacted me and said, go and see this guy. So I went to go see him back in the, it was 1982, and I mean, he lived in Brewster, New York at the time, and we were going and he was talking about all of his contacts with a being called Dinestra, who would fit the Nordic type of being to, you know, right to bit. I mean, he would be the classic Nordic type of being. Mm-hmm. But Dean never had a UFO sighting, but he would have these contact experiences. And this is what we see with a lot of contact cases. And many of them, there are no initial UFO sightings. There are direct contact without a sighting. And the person has no interest in UFOs, doesn't read the UFO material, yet they have this experience. His encounters began when he was in Germany in the 1960s in the military, where he saw a manifestation of two beings on a board that he was working on doing some drawings of actually trying to figure out number patterns for the lottery. And these entities identified themselves, and they started talking. They were like holographic projections. And as time went on, they told him they would contact him again, and they did. So the next thing that happened was pretty bizarre. Dean didn't talk about some of the things that he was able to produce, that this Dinestra person, who he claims was originally from a planet called Solarian, and Dinestra actually passed over in 1645. He was an ascended, he became an ascended being. So this was like an extraterrestrial who became an angel of some sort. You know, very rare. So Dean took me down to his basement. He started talking. Well, this guy's smoking a cigarette and chugging a beer at the same time. Okay, so this is not some kind of mystical sort of person.
Right.
And all of a sudden he goes blank. And he's just standing there like he's in a trance. And I'm looking at him, and this guy is gone. Where the heck is going on here, I'm thinking to myself. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of minutes, he snaps out of it, and he says, he was here. I said, who was here? And he said, Dinestra. And he goes into a cabinet and gives me this binder, and he said, he instructed me to give this to you. And I opened it up. And there were these incredible drawings of technical devices in there that he did in the 60s. And I said, what am I supposed to do with these? He said, in time, you're going to know what to do with these. Now, there's 32 diagrams plus about 20-something pages of an unknown language.
Yeah.
Now, these diagrams are just not things that are scribbled down. They're in vivid color. They're incredible. And the way they were done, he said one night, Dinestra told him that he was going to perform and do something and that things were going to happen. So one night while Dean is laying in bed, he claims that these little hooded entities came into the room and started placing something inside of his brain. And there was a device that appeared in front of him that vibrated his head. And the next day when he woke up from it, he had a headache. And he all of a sudden ran to a drafting store, and he knew exactly what to buy. He never had any art experience.
Yeah.
And he went back into a room and locked himself in the room. And a couple days later, comes out with these 32 diagrams, and he said he would put the graph paper on the board, and a little blue light would appear, and he would connect the dots. And he knew exactly what color to shade it in. Now, when we looked at these diagrams, I mean, they're incredible, and they're symmetrical also. When we looked at them under a microscope, for example, the same distance in micrometers on each line of these cross sections of these diagrams on the right hand side is exactly the same on the left hand side. A person couldn't do that. The only flaws that are in the diagram are with the flaws from the pencils that he used, the drafting pencils that he used.
Mm-hmm.
And they represent technical devices. There's devices there for cold fusion. There's a device there that's called a photon accelerator. There's a device there for a three-dimensional viewing screen. And back then, of course, three-dimensional viewing screens were completely science fiction, but now they have them. And there's a device called, different devices doing different things. I mean, the diagrams went to a master draftsman to look at. The master draftsman said whoever did this had at least 20 years of drafting experience. Bean did not have that experience. Then they went to an engineer, and everything on there was electrically and accurate. And people would say, who did these things? And there were things in there, for example, in the coiling of different types of electrical components, the way coils were wound, which was something radically different that people looked at and said, this is a radical way of doing this. And one of the devices, by the way, was constructed, something called a helical coil, and it produced a current and an electromagnetic pulse that was several times stronger than anything that was available, but unfortunately, it burned out. Because, you see, in the diagrams, there's enough to whet your appetite and to intrigue you, but there's not enough information to thoroughly build these things.
Right, right.
So the diagrams went to Princeton University, they went to Northwestern University, they went to MIT, and everyone was amazed by them. And they said, we have to meet the person who did these. And, of course, when I open my big mouth and say how the diagrams were done, these scientists would just walk away and laugh.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I can't get involved with that. But that's not the only thing that Dean did. He also produced about 15 pages of an unknown language, which was looked at by a number of linguistic people, indicating that it's a real language with over 200 characters. And over the years, I've been slowly been able to translate them because he gave a number of pages which I call the Rosetta Stone. These symbols, by the way, are combinations of every language on Earth into one master language, which is bizarre because, you know, people think that, you know, it's the spoken language actually came from one central source on Earth, mm-hmm. from human beings, and spread out and mutated and changed over the years. I mean, even today we could see language changing. For example, if you look at the way people wrote and talked back in the 1600s and compare it with the way people talk today and write today, it's almost like a different language, but it's still English.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
So, and it's interesting to know that according to legends, it's saying that the written language was given to us by angels or higher order beings to help the human race communicate. But in the language that he did are all different symbols from every language on Earth, and some of them are no longer used. Sumerian, Greek, certain Greek symbols are in there. Many different symbols from many different cultures are in there, and this is the key for interpreting it. Now, finally, this guy did three full manuscripts that have never been published. One is called The Celestial Citizen. One is called The Book of Solarian, and it's pretty far-out stuff. And finally, in the 90s, I visited him, and he said now he's not doing diagrams anymore. He was doing a mathematical sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me all of these equations that he was doing. Now, at the time I looked at him, I didn't even understand them.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, today what Dean was doing was chaos equations. And he was doing them not in a linear fashion, but writing them in an almost a dimensional fashion, a three-dimensional way to solve equations. And he said, certain numbers are given to me, and I'm allowed to win the lottery. So what are you talking about? Now, Dean was a very poor guy, yet these communicators would allow him to win the lottery if they wanted him to get something.
Yeah.
So I went to the place where he bought most of his lottery tickets in Putnam Lake, New York. And I asked the fella about J. Dean Fagerstrom. The guy goes, yeah, he's weird. He wins more than anybody else. Now, the thing is that these guys, Dinestra, the Dinestra Group, I call them,
mm-hmm.
they wanted Dean to start producing music. Of course, Dean could not afford a piano, an electric piano.
Yeah.
But he won the lottery to buy one with all of the recording equipment.
Yeah.
And when I went to see him in the 90s, he produced 100 tapes.
Wow.
And he claims that the composer, Franz Liszt, was now channeling through him, who's now an ascended being also, channeling through him, producing music. And he played me some of the tapes, and I said, well, Dean, that's pretty amazing. But, you know, some people would say just listening to the tapes that you could have copied it from somewhere else. You know, I'm trying to be the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
And I said, well, Dean, can you play something? And he said, I can't because I don't know when it's going to happen when they take over to allow me to play. That's why he said he has the recorder all hooked up on the piano, so when he gets that feeling, he could turn on the recorder, because everything after that is blank.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, I'm trying to coax him to go at the piano, and I go over to the piano to make sure it's not one of those pianos which, you know, program in and, you know, make the thing. All of a sudden, he pushes me out of the way, puts on the recorder, and steps, sits down and starts playing this amazing piece. And I couldn't believe it. You know, this is a guy who had no experience with music.
Yeah.
So I ended up taking three of the cassettes that he did. And he said it's all Franz Liszt. And you know, I don't know what Franz Liszt sounds like back then. So I went to a contact of mine. And of course, when you're involved with paranormal investigations and UFO investigations, you've got to work with a number of people as consultants.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a professor at the Juilliard School of Music in New York. And I called him up on the phone. And I said, I'm going to play you a tape. Can you tell me what style it is, or what style? And I play it for 5 seconds, and he goes, stop. He goes, it's Liszt, Franz Liszt. He said, the person playing it, he said, it's playing exactly like Franz Liszt did, and who's ever playing is a master piano player. So he said, let me, he said, can you play more of this? I played about 5 minutes, and he said, stop. He said, it's definitely Franz Liszt, but what you're playing, and finally he heard all three tapes, and he said, these are pieces that have never been published that are definitely Liszt. So, you know, that kind of blew me away right there. And this indicated to me that perhaps, like J. Dean Fagerstrom, some people are in contact with something that is other than their own imaginations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
the guy produced so much stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, with channelers, you know, you go to them and you want to hear all this philosophical garbage.
Yeah.
And when they start channeling, you know, they all of a sudden they get this Indian accent or this, you know, accent and so on and so on. And I always joke and say, you know, what? You know, there's no one with a Brooklyn accent that has ascended to the other side that's channeling? I mean, give me a break. They all sound Indian. I mean, you know, they take on this mystical, yes, you must do this and do that. And in one particular case, for example, this channeler kept on talking about the Space Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And the Space Brothers will come and save us, and the Space Brothers say this. And I said, I raised my hand and I said, excuse me. I said, you may ask a question. Okay, fine. Aren't there any Space Sisters out there? I said, I would hate to think it's a male-dominated universe out there. But you see, this particular person who was channeling was a guy who was brought up in the 50s in a male-dominated society.
Yeah.
So the Space Brothers obviously have to rule outer space in his ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and in another case, for example, you know, I go and see these channelers, and one of them said, oh, yes, we're going to be channeling devices that you can build so that you can talk to us and contact us directly. I said, well, that's great. I said, because, you know, this secondhand stuff is getting a little boring here. and they said, but it will take 6 months for you to come to these channeling sessions so that all the information can be given to you. And of course, you know, a lot of these channelers, for one session, they charge $100 a pop a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, 6 months, I said, why don't you just come down in one of your spaceships and drop it off, and I'll pick it up, and we could save ourselves a lot of time. I was never invited back.
Yeah. Well, it's an amazing story, because as you point out here, and I just let you go with it because I love the story so much that I wanted to make sure people heard as much as possible. We should point out that the images, a few of the sketches are in the book, so people, if they want to get a view of this, they should definitely pick up the book, because the sketches are amazing. And as you point out, this guy, he sounds like a pretty blue-collar guy, and he didn't have much money, but according to these different experts in different fields, he should have 20 years' experience as a draftsman and be a master pianist as well. I mean, come on, that doesn't add up in our reality, if you will. So,
and all of his mm-hmm. diagrams are scientifically accurate.
Yeah.
They were done, you know, by somebody with engineering backgrounds that are unbelievable. There are things there, for example, that are being speculated now and thought about now that are in those diagrams. And he held on to those diagrams from the 60s until I walked in his basement, until he got the command or communication by this Dinestra to turn over these diagrams to me. First time I ever met him, out of the blue. He's just holding on to these things for years, and he gives them to me. He says, they're yours now. I mean, that was pretty blew me away right there, especially when I opened them up and I saw these amazing things.
Yeah.
Fagerstrom is probably one of only three channelers, contactees, that have produced something that I would say is extraordinary. All the other ones, all the other channelers I've investigated, is just pure and philosophical nonsense. And many of them talk over and over. They never answer your questions properly. They sound like lawyers in the courtroom with all kinds of spiritual rhetoric.
Yeah. I thought it was also interesting that you had a later sort of encounter, if you will, with Dinestra. You went to a different channeling session. That one sounded like there was definitely something going on. Because,
well, you know what? And yeah, and that blew the people away also. And I'll tell you, I can describe it kind of brief if you want.
Well, the point I was going to mention was that Dinestra warned you that you're the target of a very ancient evil force, which would kind of trouble me if I was in that position. How did you react to that whole thing? I guess you can't really react at all. What are you going to do? What are you going to do if you're the target of an ancient evil force, right?
Yeah, well, you know, there were people who contacted me who said they were in contact with 100-something different aliens, extraterrestrials,
mm-hmm.
and that they channeled through automatic writing. And I went to their house to see them, and of course not expecting much of anything. And they started channeling, and, you know, these extraterrestrials start coming through. And all of a sudden, the temperature of the room drops. I mean, it got so cold, everybody was looking at their breath. And people there were getting headaches. The dog that was there that was once friendly was now showing its teeth at me.
Yeah.
And every time I moved out of my chair, it would come over and sit at me and make like it was going to bite me. But it was very friendly when we came in. During that time, the phone kept on ringing. A pot flew off the stove and went up against the wall. There were knockings on the windows. And then all of a sudden, this person doing the automatic writing, their hands started vibrating back and forth. And then another message came on in a different writing saying, and another person was saying, who is this? And it said, I will speak only to Phil. And I said, who is this? And it signed in Dinestra.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, these people, the Fagerstrom case was not publicized at the time. As a matter of fact, I had just left Fagerstrom a week ago and did the whole Dinestra thing. Didn't even talk about it with anybody. Wasn't published in any sort of thing. Yet, this came through, which really surprised me. I mean,
yeah.
It took me by surprise. And, yes, there were all kinds of warnings and everything that and a lot of crazy things happened that night. And that was another case where a channeler produced something that made me think, and also there was a lot of manifestation of physical phenomena in the room that took place that particular evening. And think of it this way. Suppose these people were channeling, let's say, extraterrestrials out there in this federation of planets.
Mm-hmm.
According to what I understand, Dinestra, who's a higher order of being, couldn't get directly to the channeler. So Dinestra channeled through these extraterrestrials, sort of like a medium, used them as a medium,
yeah,
as a jump space, to jump the jumper, to get down to the channeler so that he can get in. And because after Dinestra signed out, these other aliens, so-called aliens, came on and saying, who was that? They're like talking with each other. We don't know who it is, and this communication has to end now.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty bizarre night.
Yeah. It's very strange. These are some of the stories in the book, folks, so go out and pick it up, because it really blew my mind.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?